You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. You may know me as someone who said she would listen to your podcast, but really, I didn't. But in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today, I'm passing the microphone to Recode's senior finance editor, Teddy Schlieffer. He interviewed venture capitalist Samil Shah, the founder and general partner of Haystack. Take it away, Teddy.
Thanks, Kara. I'm here today with Samil Shah, who is the founder of Haystack, which is a venture capital firm, and he's also a venture partner at Lightspeed. We'll get into what exactly a venture partner is in a bit. But Samil, welcome to Recode Decode.
I'm excited to be in the red chair.
Here you are in the red chair. How's your summer going?
Summer's going great. I can't complain. I just need an extra day a week.
Extra day? Well, you can, you know, the land of innovation can invent an eighth day. You going on vacation anywhere or what's?
No, we've got little kids, so our vacations are like 2 hours when they nap.
Okay.
And we vowed not to go on a plane with them for a while.
How old are
We have a daughter who is entering kindergarten next week. She's 5 and a half.
Okay.
And we've got twin boys who will be 3 in October.
Okay. So that's you feel like that's still not the age where they can survive a long plane flight.
I still have some travel PTSD from last summer.
Okay.
So I need to get over that.
Got it. Well, I assume that, you know, this will be, it's a sleepy season here. I mean, I feel like people are still not totally around, a lot out of office supplies. I was out for 2 weeks, which was like phenomenal and did not have to do much of anything. But I was still, you know, still kind of monitoring things, but I was amazed at like how little I missed.
Yeah, there's not much going on, but there's a lot of private deal activity going on and a lot of people doing rounds and taking rounds off the table when things are a little bit quieter. So there's quite a lot of activity. It's just not...
It's beneath the surface.
Yeah, beneath the surface.
Got it. So we're going to talk a little bit about kind of who you are and what you do. And then at the end, we'll kind of talk more about where the industry is headed. I think you're a really interesting person, as I've told you, because I feel like you almost approach venture capital as I do, as like almost a reporter, as a student. I don't think I've ever seen anybody before. I remember I once saw one of your blog posts or somewhere that you wrote, like, you were curious about like some exit prices that had not yet been announced publicly, which is obviously something that like I would do in my business. And I feel like you're just very observant about, you know, various firms, both at an inside baseball level, but and we can talk about this a little bit, but you didn't start here as an insider. You're not the son of someone who kind of was in the business. You didn't grow up, you know, as an associate, as an analyst, as an associate, which I think kind of gives you a bit more of an outsider eye on the way the industry is shaped. So let me just, you know, kind of start with like describing kind of how you got involved in Silicon Valley. You moved here, what?
Yeah, I lived in the Bay Area in San Francisco up until about 2006, went to grad school on the East Coast and thought I would move to Asia, and then decided that was a whole different saga, that I didn't want to move to Asia or settle on the East Coast. I'd gotten married. So my wife and I wanted to come back, and so she had a role at Stanford. We moved to Palo Alto. You know, I knew a few people in the area, but not really.
Right.
And just try to get involved with startups or on the investor side.
How old were you at this time?
How old was I? Probably 32, 33.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were, you know, the age of a lot of kind of VCs who were already at established firms.
Like, oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I was actually more interested in working at startups, but I was trying to just increase the surface area of what to do. And that was a pretty rough time. Like, I was lucky that some of the folks that I was in Boston that I was consulting with kind of bridged me to move here, and I was still working with them for income.
Yep.
But I spent a good, I think I did a calendar audit, like 11 months just trying to crack in, trying to work at any sort of startup. They could have been seed funded. They could have been growth stage. And I think I brought good entrepreneurial energy. I just wasn't like slotting into a role.
Yeah.
And then I would, you know, in parallel also talk to all sorts of investors, you know, like $40 million funds up to like $1 billion funds to just see if I could get a role. And that went nowhere either. So that was a pretty rough 11-month period. And ultimately, I ended up working at a friend's company where I just said, hey, I'm going to show up and start working with you guys. I was like that frustrated.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think they paid me in like Diet Cokes and sandwiches.
Right.
But that was it.
And this was like a pretty concerted effort to like, you said, hey, I'm here in Silicon Valley. I want to break in. I mean, a lot of origin stories here are like, you know, they just happened to meet someone at a party. And so it was almost like an accidental rise. But for you, this was like, hey, I want to work at startups or in venture capital. I'm going to find opportunities actively and network actively. And it was...
Yeah, I mean, I was meeting a lot of people. I was definitely being called in for interviews and getting far in certain processes. Got to meet a lot of VCs through that process. I was also writing a lot online.
Right. You can actually write. I'm like...
A lot of venture capitalists
who have ghostwriters or folks helping them.
Yeah, you know, it just sort of happened naturally, but I have always liked writing and did a lot of writing in roles before graduate school and during graduate school. And I never thought of myself as a writer, but it was just something I do to like express myself in a sort of like a cathartic thing. But what ended up happening was I lived like four blocks. You know, my wife was working at Stanford, so we lived in downtown Palo Alto. She could walk into campus.
Yep.
And I ended up living like four blocks from Quora. And during that time, Quora was in beta mode. And it was like a very hot venture capital deal. It was much talked about. Like you couldn't be on the site. They were trying to get like really big names on the site to contribute firsthand knowledge. And so I got an invite to join Quora.
From a neighbor or someone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just started writing on there and I just started noticing that like people were picking it up. And then Eric Schoenfeld, Arrington, MG at TechCrunch were like, hey, we like your writing. Do you want to just guest post here a couple times? So I guest post a few times there. I did like this triple part thing on Quora because I was like, hey, I think Quora is an interesting thing. I think my first post was about Twitter and I just like the products. And so a couple of them just took off and they were like, hey, why don't you just keep doing it? So long story short, I ultimately started getting roles at startups. And while I was doing that, I was on the side just for fun. Ended up being probably the most frequent outside contributor to TechCrunch. And I think a lot of people probably read something I've written over the years, and I was just very consistent about it.
Right.
Yeah.
So during that first year, I mean, when you're trying to get, you know, intros to the right firms, like, I mean, you're pretty candid about the struggle you had to make that happen.
Yeah.
I mean, did you feel like when you think back on that, that was like a fair struggle that it was like, it should, like, do you think it should be hard to break into this business, into venture capital? Well, or was it, did you feel it was like, to what extent do you feel like it was a meritocratic, got to make it work? And if you can, you can, if you can, and you've won.
I think venture, and we can touch more on this later too, if you want. Looking back on it, I don't blame any of the VC firms for not hiring me. It's really, you really have to have context about what you're going to do before you come in. You have to have a point of view. Usually that point of view is shaped by participating in the ecosystem before.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other things you could do in academia and things. And it is a trust and relationship game. Just picking off someone off the street and having them come into your investment partner meetings and stuff. So having worked with these firms in various capacities over the years and now knowing what I know, it was completely the right thing to do. What surprised me more was startups that would just not entertain me as a hire. And then I kind of look at their trajectory.
So shot and fried, maybe?
Not really, but just, it was just sort of surprising to me.
Right.
Yeah.
I just feel like, I mean, I feel like obviously Silicon Valley is so connection-based, and I just always wonder, like, you know, I think the downside is what if it's not as meritocratic as it could be? And, you know, if you're a great schmoozer, but a terrible VC, you can still make it here.
I don't know. There are two separate things. There's kind of schmoozing and being known and being kind of a gadfly.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, you can kind of get away with stuff and move around. But like VC firms aren't stupid either. Like they're not just going to go after some gadfly. There has to be a there.
Right.
There has to be like, you know, for writing, for example, someone may say, well, like, well how do you write and get, oh, you're just writing and getting into deals. Well, the founders aren't going to work with you unless you actually work with them. So it kind of works up until a point, but you have to deliver in real life.
Right. So at this point, so you've been looking around for a year, you know, you've been, keep, you know, pretty candid about the failure, about kind of the failure to achieve, you don't walk into Sequoia. Is there like a big break you feel like you had? Like, and when you showed up here, you know, you've obviously been putting in the spade work to try and find the right gig. Is there a moment that jumps out at you?
There was one moment. I think I had finished two funds. So we glossed over a thing. So like I had a couple, I was competing for like this last role I was like gunning for. I was a finalist, very well-known firm. I have a lot of friends there. They were very gracious. They were like, you lost out to someone with way more experience.
And yep.
That was kind of a rock bottom moment. And so I had two friends kind of pick me up and they were like, hey, look, just start the small fund. It'll be your kind of ticket to go do your next thing. Show me a deal flow.
This is Haystack.
Yeah. So I kind of just started that not knowing what I was getting into. And the first two funds just hit a number of companies, like very, very lucky. And probably 3 years into that, a bunch of people, because I knew a lot of VCs, like I got a tremendous amount of offers. And so I think there was like the first time, this was like mid-2015.
Yeah.
Where I was like, oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. So I didn't take it as like, I've arrived. I would never say that. But it was like, it did feel like a little bit of a turning point of like, okay, there are a bunch of people who are like, okay, come over now.
Right.
Yeah.
So the move you essentially made was, I'm going to do my own shop, right? I mean, that was kind of the move that allowed you to say, hey, I don't need to be hired by these firms.
I don't know if I would say that either. Okay. I mean, it was definitely something I entertained. We had one kid at the time. My wife was pregnant with twins at the time. So I was like, ooh.
Right.
You know, and we don't have our own net worth or liquidity or stuff. So I did entertain one of those offers. And then I had three other firms, to their credit, kind of intercept those offers and offer me like a hybrid role. They were like, you keep doing what you're doing. We'll invest in your funds. Be a venture partner with us. Hang out and keep doing your own fund until, like, you know, you've taken off and you've got this, like, even if it's a 1-5% chance to have your own operation,
yeah,
you should do it, like, even if you have to crash land. And if you crash land, you'll have a role somewhere. So I ended up taking a role with GGV Capital.
Right.
They were about $4 billion in assets now, about 20 years old. $4 billion under management across China and the U.S. And that was just an amazing experience. And I give them a lot of credit for kind of creating that role. And yeah. I don't think anyone else in the Valley kind of has that role.
Right.
So I'm very fortunate.
Right. We'll talk about that. I'll talk about kind of what that means to do. Be a venture partner sec, but like just kind of more generally, I mean, there's a lot of talk here about in Silicon Valley about failing up, right? And like, you know, you can fail and still be successful and everyone learns from failures. People who are skittish though to kind of talk about like, you know, applying for jobs and not getting them. From a brand perspective as like a VC, like do you understand kind of why people are like, just want to talk about the good stuff here?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of layers to unpack with that. But yeah. I think what it comes down to is people don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear
it. Listeners don't want to hear it.
I think listeners do. But yeah. Like, let's say the LPs in funds yeah. or the founders who are going to those funds.
Sure.
The employees are employed by the companies that are fueled by venture capitalists. They don't want to hear necessarily how some of it works.
Right.
And so there's a little game to play around that.
Right. Cool. Samil, got a few more questions for you, but first we're going to take a quick break so Kara Swisher can tell the listeners about our sponsors. Kara?
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc. Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life.
If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Thanks, Kara. We're back here with Samil Shah, the founder of Haystack and a venture partner at Lightspeed. I want to talk a little bit about kind of, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about kind of what venture capital is. I feel like, you know, people watch movies or they read books or they watch Shark Tank and they just think that this is how, you know, people just run around all day, barking orders, making money. It seems just to be the good life. But from getting to know people, there's obviously a ton of grinding that goes into the business, and lots of days isn't easy. And we're just talking about a failure. And there are tons of venture capitalists who never see any success or never see what's called carry or, you know, the profit, basically. And people don't hear about them. So I want to talk a little bit about just kind of what it means to what you actually do all day on a day-to-day level.
So a lot of questions in there. And this is one of my favorite topics. But I definitely don't want to come off as someone like, here, let me tell you all about how VC works.
Yeah.
Like, I'm kind of 5 years in. Very much a student of it, and I've been lucky to see a lot of it up front.
Yeah.
And no one's going to or should be crying on the behalf of VCs, because when they raise a fund, they have guaranteed contractual income.
Right, right.
Right. So it is
not
hard.
Not paycheck to paycheck here.
Yeah, it is hard, but for these larger funds, I think what's happening is that, like, I think of things of like, okay, let's just put things into this cauldron. And so what are we going to put? We're going to put the culture around the Social Network movie and Facebook Rising, Shark Tank culture, you know, hundreds of millions of people in the country watching Shark Tank and understanding what the role of the investor in that big seat is.
Yep.
And then things like HBO, Silicon Valley, proliferation of things like YC. And so people have this picture of what a VC is and does. And I think what's happening at the same time, and the reason that the monolithic definition doesn't apply, is that VC is also growing and mutating as startup formation is growing and mutating. And so you have small funds, you have crypto funds, you have sector-focused funds, you have geography-focused funds. You have, you know, hundreds of funds under $100 million. You have now 10 to 20, 30 funds over $1 billion. And so it's just really different depending on where you sit.
Right. So walk me through a typical day. Like, what do you, you know, I think there's this, the conception out there is that the venture capitalist is sort of the captain of the ship and they're running around and giving money and fulfilling dreams. But like, what's like the...
There is, you know, that is a big component of the job, is like finding people that you're attracted to, that you believe in.
Right.
That you want to...
But I think the image is that like the VC holds all the cards, right? And lots of times, obviously, on a hot deal.
No.
Like...
Yeah. No. So let me answer this a couple of ways and we can click on anything you like. So every Monday, I try to be really structured now. So every Monday, I go down to Sand Hill Road. I spend the day at Lightspeed, where I'm a venture partner.
Yep.
It's an amazing experience. You know, after 3 years doing that with GGV, now I get to do that with Lightspeed. You know, top tier firms at the top of their game. Just an amazing experience, and I'm learning every Monday I go down there. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'm in San Francisco trying to meet the next great founder, trying to help a founder that I've already backed, helping people in the community. You know, there's a lot of that.
So it's a lot of coffee meetings. That's, you have a 1 p.m., a 2 p.m., a 3 p.m.
I don't do it like that.
Yeah.
I try to just do a few each day and make them longer. I did that for years, but
I'm always amazed when I talk to VCs, just like if they ever show me like what their Google calendar looks like. It's just like,
it's kind of a mess.
Yeah. How do you have time to deal with any crisis du jour?
On Fridays, I just stay in my home office. I don't make any meeting plans or call plans.
Got it.
Part of that is just to like build some quiet into my schedule. And I also feel like the job that I have at hand is to actually, because I think a lot of VCs overweight and overmarket how much they help.
Yep.
Right. And so I tell people very openly, like, I'm trying to find people who don't need a lot of help. And I'm trying to attract them to me, explain to them how I work with them. And then they can pull from me.
Right, right.
And so because that selection is such an important piece of what I try to do, and it's so noisy and you meet a lot of people, I find that I need to bake in parts of my schedule where my mind can actually rest and my subconscious can kind of kick in and I can say, well, hey, I'm still thinking about that person. I'm still thinking about that product and service. And if I catch my brain at rest, starting to think more about it, I start to get excited.
So this is, most of this is your Friday time.
Yeah, Friday and weekend. And it's just kind of baking that into the schedule to like just think about the commitment more. There's also some times where I meet somebody and I commit within a day or hours.
Sure.
And so I try to be as extinctive as possible
right.
in those situations.
So you're pretty intentional about time management. You think to yourself like,
yeah,
lots of VCs, it's just like, you know, or for instance, my job is just like dealing with incoming, right? And like,
it's the number one thing VCs privately, I feel, discuss is like hacks around time management, how to better manage their time.
Yeah.
And it becomes tougher once you're part of a large partnership because you get pulled into other things,
sure.
you get pulled into administrative things. But I'm, you know, when you have three little kids, you're running these funds. I have this kind of dual role. I have to be just like completely vigilant over my time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you're a venture partner, Lightspeed. You used to be a venture partner, GGV. The title has always, you know, seemed to me like it seems like a part-time, you know, gig. But I do think that obviously there's a lot of confusion around what titles really mean here in Silicon Valley.
Yeah. There's a good Quora thread mm-hmm. about like what is a venture partner.
Yeah.
And I think when that thread was written, there were like kind of one or two things as like somebody who's like trying out venture and it's like kind of an entry step in. And so you'll see a lot of GPs on Sand Hill Road that would actually start as a venture partner.
Right.
And I actually think it's pretty smart. There are other people who, you know, maybe coming in and they just want to do a couple deals in a couple areas, but they don't want to be fully baked into the partnership.
Yep.
I think for me, the way it started with GGV and now with Lightspeed is that, what's happened in the world of venture is like a lot of these larger funds have scaled. They've now hitting like global opportunities. And so they become multi-strategy. And I'm, I guess, probably situated in a unique way where I'm a single GP that's invested in a lot of companies that have scaled up and been followed by the big VCs.
Yep.
And that have gone on to like, you know, do multiple hundred million dollar revenue businesses. And so I think, because it was normalized while I was working at GGB, other firms are more open to those structures. Hmm. And so the venture partner is a way to like
recognize that. Feel like there's a lot, this is a more common thing today than it was when you signed up at GGB.
I think more firms would do it
yeah.
now based on the fact that I was been able to do it.
Right.
I think the question is, who do you do it with?
Right.
And so they're supply constrained.
So what does someone who's a general partner at Lightspeed do that you don't? I mean, what's the...
Oh, yeah. So, like, I'm trying to invest in companies that are pre-Series A. The round sizes are, like, $2 million,
yeah.
$2.5 million or less.
Yeah.
That's the stage I like.
Right.
That's the stage where I think I can add value, where I feel comfortable with selection. Some of my partners at Lightspeed, for example, you know, they might write an $8 million check into sure. one company and make a reserve commitment. Or might write a $25 million check into a company and be the second board member.
Right.
And I think the level of commitment that check brings versus what you do at seed is just completely different.
Yeah. No, but in terms of like at Lightspeed, right? I mean, so obviously you're there on Mondays.
Yeah.
If there's a decision on Wednesday, is part of the challenge being only a venture partner to like make sure you have,
you know, every firm has its
access.
Own
yeah.
every firm has its own investment decision process. Some of the firms are advocacy models. Some of the firms are consensus. Some of them are voting.
Yeah, this is how firms make decisions about which companies to fund.
The way I see Lightspeed going is people form deal teams, and if there's a deal kind of moving, there's a team kind of forming, and then they bring it to the partnership on Monday. They'll ask for a rating sometimes to get a calibration from the partnership. There'll be an active discussion, really structured active discussion, both around the opportunity, the market, and also testing the partner's own personal willingness and resolve to commit to the opportunity.
Right.
Which I find those really fascinating. And then there's a vote.
Right. Is that different than kind of the way that, so GGV, for folks who don't know, is a firm that's well known basically for being very active in China as well. I feel like yeah. they're probably the most, one of the two or three.
But
most
also
prominent.
Remember here, they did Series A or B in Open Door, HashiCorp,
yep.
Wish,
yep.
Some pretty major companies.
How is, I mean, tonight you've seen two firms kind of up close. I mean, how is GGB different just in terms of?
Yeah, I think every firm, and I've been inside other partner meetings too, has their own flavor. GGB, they have a smaller partnership in terms of the MDs at the top. They're only five or six at a time.
Right.
And they tend to bring things to the partnership, and because the partners are distributed between US and China, are kind of more having one-on-one conversations, and then they have a group weekly meeting every Monday night. And so they figure it out that way.
Got
but
it.
Every firm's different. If you had people from different firms.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
No, it's fascinating here.
Yeah. And so going back to your question too, of like what folks would like to be during the week, it's very much an outbound field job. You know, it goes back to almost journalism, right? You're going out, hitting your beat, talking to people. Like there are a couple of people who focus on fintech or real estate or, you know, infrastructure, and they're going, working with their companies, talking to sources.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. No, I mean, I think a lot of the best VCs kind of have a journalistic mindset.
Yeah.
Another misconception that I think is definitely not talked about sufficiently in VC is the role of luck. You always see a Medium post that eloquently describes how the company that was just acquired, you know, they had total forethought into how everything was going to unfold. Obviously, there are other examples of companies that fail that maybe the decision process was perfectly good and, you know, based on a rational, you know, they should have been rewarded for it rationally based on, but you know, like, do you agree that a lot of this is luck? I mean, I know the follow-up obviously is like, if a lot of it is luck, should VCs be as venerated as they are? And I think it's what makes people uncomfortable. And I think that's why lots of VCs don't talk about luck.
I think to answer this requires some nuance and digging a little bit. I believe absolutely that luck is a major component of these things, because all you need in your career is like one investment to just pop.
Yeah.
And it's, I think if you talk to people in private, it's very hard to know in the moments of early investment, like how that could even be possible.
Sure. Especially if you're doing seed,
right?
You're at the, there's a huge variance in kind of what can happen.
Now, where I would downplay luck is when you see people get lucky a lot, because they have a lot of choices. And so they're selecting out of those choices. And to select well out of those choices is pretty remarkable. Like if you look at, you know, just to pick on a few people, but like,
sure,
you know, Matt Kohler's now been a benchmark for 10 years. If you look at the companies he's associated with it, dollars in, valuation, outcome, just on an Excel sheet, it's pretty remarkable.
Right.
Is that luck?
Each individual decision might be luck, right? I mean, but your argument is, you know, if you're hitting enough home runs, then
because you would imagine everyone would want to work with Matt in some way on the consumer side, and so he's got all these choices.
Right.
You know, if you think about like one of the co-founders of Lightspeed, Ravi Mhatre, I think in the last six quarters he's had $1 billion plus platform enterprise outcome.
Right.
Is that luck? I don't know. I don't think so.
Right.
So I think there are people who graduate into this level where they're both attracting more and more people, more and more quality opportunities,
right,
and they're selecting very precisely amongst those opportunities.
Are there investments you've made where you kind of think back about like, you know, a great investment that, you know, you made that you should have been successful, and then it's like unlucky and you like it doesn't pan out? And like, I'm sure you think about, you do some self-reflection all the time, right? I know you do like charts where you look at.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's not your fault, right?
I'll give you, And the way I shortcut that at seed, which is very different than what like Ravi or Matt would do at a Series A commitment, is like I try to focus on partnering with a person or a set of people in a market, knowing that things may change and that would I make the same decision to invest in this type of person again? And generally, I feel like I get that right and I'm comfortable with that. Again, the dollars aren't as big. So I'll give you two examples. So one example where things didn't work out was a company called Lux Valet.
Okay.
So Lux had amazing like cohort retention numbers. They were making quite a bit of money.
What does the company do?
Oh, sorry. Lux Valet was started in San Francisco, moved out to eight cities pretty quickly. You would tap in your location in the city. A valet would come and take your car and park it and then do other stuff to it and like fill it with gas, do a car wash, change the tires, fill up the tires, and give it back to you at the end of the day at a different location. So you didn't have to deal with garages and you could use Uber.
Plus you got a clean car and right.
Yeah. And just a lot of people used it not just in San Francisco. And what ended up happening is that the company wasn't able to, as hard as they tried, wasn't able to manage losing money on a unit economic basis with going deeper inside the wallet.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing about them is if you ever, anyone who ever used Lux Valet or if you search it on YouTube, all the valets arrived by scooter or skateboard.
Okay.
And so it was ahead like of, a year before, you know, people doing scooters. But like, what if at Lux, I mean, you could just do what ifs everywhere, right?
Right.
What if 2 months before they decided to sell the company, they were like, let's just turn into like a scooter share or something like that.
Sure.
Who knows? But I went into that investment having made a number of on-demand investments that had worked. I saw a lot of people using it. I thought parking was, you know, people spend in the U.S. like $40 to $50 billion a year. So I did all that analytical work. I knew the founders, but that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Versus like I was the only seed fund outside of True Ventures to invest in the seed round of HashiCorp. And I'll probably never make an investment like that again in my life. And I just met the kid through a friend who he worked with.
Right.
Thought he was brilliant. I spent like weeks getting to know him.
So that's an example of luck working.
Absolutely. Like there's no way you could see a multi-billion dollar company potential just right. like by meeting some 21-year-old kid.
Right. So that gets me to another, I think, misconception or well, something just really irks me about the way VC works, which is like, and we talked about this as you tried to break into VC, but it's still pretty clubby overall. I mean, I think the industry, like, you know, there's an in-group and you got to break in and it's not totally easy. And, you know, if you know the right investor, you meet the right company and like, it's not very, very, it's hard maybe for a reason, but there is a club and there is an in-group and we can talk about this a little bit later when we get into stuff about like diversity, you know, obviously the in-group isn't helpful to that. Do you feel like, you know, in your experience that running your own fund, but kind of being attached to some existing big heavyweight funds, like, are there advantages to kind of being not part of the in-group and not being, you know, one of the 10 partners at one of the five biggest funds? What are the advantages of a lone wolf, I guess?
I mean, I can only answer that for me, which is,
yeah,
I've only been doing this 5 years and I've been lucky to have been around even before that and mentored and continually mentored by a number of VCs. Very actively mentored. So I view it as a way to like get smarter. I don't think I was selected for that because I'm cool. I don't think I'm an insider in that way. Like I have inside knowledge, but I don't have all the inside knowledge. And so I fundamentally believe like anyone can still come here. There are now all these programs like AngelList has an angel track. YC has like a investor school. First Round Capital has like all these things that bring people into investing. There's AngelList out there. So there are ways for someone who wants to get into venture to show that they're passionate about it, to show that they can structure their thoughts and share judgment.
Yep.
And people will listen to them. And so I still fundamentally believe that.
You still think there are models of ways to break in.
Absolutely.
That are not. I mean, some of it's obviously connection-based, but like,
it is a relationship thing. Like no one is going to just hire somebody off the street. Like what I tell people, like
I have people
coming to me every week saying, how do I get into venture? And what's really ironic about this is I've helped a number of people get their venture capital roles even before I had anything going for myself. So I saw a lot of this up front. And the number one thing I tell people is come bearing gifts. So you go meet a VC, don't ask for a job.
Yeah.
Tell him or her the companies you're meeting that are interesting.
Right. Give, then ask. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like anyone that's gone to talk to, like think of how many resumes Sequoia gets.
Sure.
A firm like that, right?
Right.
A firm like Lightspeed. Everyone will just say, great to meet you. Like, let's start working on a deal together.
Right.
And what that means is like, you have to bring something to the table.
Right. Sure.
That just is what it is.
Okay.
And the connection of the founder matters. So like, you can't just say, well, these are five companies I think are interesting. And we got to wait 5 years to see how they are. It has to go deeper. It's like, well, I think this one's interesting because I spent time with this founding team and the two of them together are just amazing to work with. You got to come see it.
Right.
So not only does the knowledge matter, but like the access and judgment around who those people are and what they're doing matters.
There you are. We're going to take another quick break right now to hear from Kara Swisher. We'll be back in a minute with Samil Shah.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up?
Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
Thanks, Kara. We're back with Sumeel Shah, who has a number of VC roles. I want to talk a little bit just at the end here about kind of the future of the business. So you recently announced a deal in Seattle. Is that what it was?
Yes.
Okay. And I know you've done some thinking about kind of, not that Seattle is, you know, the hinterlands, but, you know, deals outside of the 50-mile radius of where we're sitting. Lots of people here feel like some, or I think there's an increased conversation about like what are the moral obligations of VCs to do things outside of town? What are the economics of doing deals outside of town? There are obviously some real challenges to, you know, a startup in Wisconsin succeeding. Are you bullish or bearish on kind of deals outside of here?
You asked a couple questions there. So just in general, I feel like people expect a lot of VCs, and VCs should be more interactive and sort of sharing their knowledge and giving back to the extent that they can. I definitely agree with that. But where I probably draw the line is like, I don't think they can just solve all those problems.
Yeah.
Right. There's a limit to what they can do. They're really bandwidth constrained. I looked in my own data over the last 2 years intentionally. I've been trying to invest outside the Bay Area, mainly because I'll meet somebody here in the Bay Area at Seed and think, wow, they're great. But I don't know how they're going to build a team here and keep that team loyal. And so the bar for that is really high right now. I still invest in the Bay Area quite aggressively, but I go into that trying to mitigate that risk. Whereas when I meet teams outside the Bay Area, I found that they've already kind of spun out. Like this team in Seattle downstream,
yep,
they all came from Amazon. They're all really committed to this like very narrow thing, specialty that they're working on in ads and product search for Amazon. And I think they're going to stick together. And so I was very happy to make that investment.
Yep.
Now, depending on who you are and how much money you manage, you could have a very different view of what I'm saying. So when I looked at my own data, what I kind of concluded looking at, you know, Brad Feld recently wrote something about Foundry Group investments. Fred Wilson has been writing about where their geographies are. And you could argue at the $200 million per vehicle range, Brad's group and Fred's group have just been lights out, right? I mean, they will go down as some of the best venture capital firms in history. They've done about a quarter to a third in their home market, about half in the Bay Area, and then the rest is kind of sprinkled in different geographies. But what I've concluded in looking at their data, my data, and then like talking to other firms where I can't share the data, what I would tell a founder right now, right? If you were sitting here starting a company, I would say, if you're going to start in the Bay Area, great. You need to raise quite a bit of money and you need to know who you're going to hire and why, and understanding like how much you're going to pay those people to stay and how much equity you're going to share. Now, if you say, hey, I don't want to play that game, where do I go? I would say you go to Seattle, LA, depending on what kind of company you want to build, Denver, potentially Austin, New York and Boston.
Right.
And I think after that, and this is the tough part, I think it's really hard. Right. So there are a ton of consumer Series A's happening in yep. LA, ton of consumer and enterprise A's happening in New York, no problem. But if you want to go elsewhere, start the company, yes, there are going to be companies in Utah, there are going to be companies in Toronto. I've invested in all those areas. It's just harder.
Yeah.
And the data shows that.
Do you feel any kind of moral obligation to, you know, spread the wealth? Or do you think to yourself, my job is to make money for my investors and to...
I view it as I'm trying to invest in one of two outcomes. I'm trying to find a group, whether they're here or in Seattle, that with a little bit of seed funding, they're going to get on venture capital railroad tracks. And I'm going to help them do that. Or they're not going to raise like sort of the fuel of venture capital, and they might raise some strategic capital or follow on or local capital, and they might have a more modest but very healthy outcome.
Yep.
Those are the only two things I'm looking for. So I don't enter into those decisions thinking like, oh, it's the right thing to do, or I have some guilt that I'm bringing to it.
Sure.
I'm really trying to give the people I think are deserving of the edge and that have differentiated themselves. Like, it's just not, this isn't a grant business.
Right. Yeah, it's not.
Who have differentiated themselves through their experience and their insight, a chance.
Right. Another obviously topic that, you know, super important here, and every firm has sort of reckoned with over the last year, is just diversity initiatives. We were talking a second ago about, the club. It's mostly a white club. It's a male club.
This is a Richard Kirby has been writing a lot about it, a friend of mine.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, do you feel like, how bullish are you that it's changing? There's obviously a debate about what motives are behind folks changing. Is it just for PR? Or is it just for...
Make two comments. One is that I think the larger firms that are investing on a national scale or global scale probably need, from a business point of view, need to have diverse points of view in their partnership discussions and investment discussions to make better decisions over the long arc of the next 10, 20, 30 years. I think there's just a business case for that. So it's just very easy to make that case.
Yep.
If it's two people doing a micro fund in Seattle, I don't know how critical that is, right? The second thing I would say, which I would love to see more of and have helped people do it, is like the ability for people to start their new funds is amazing. So I think there's this whole bunch of people that want certain names to like tilt over or change. But I almost say back, like, that's great, and they should, and they have their business reason to. But like, you know, like, let's say Benchmark formed in, 1996, 1997?
Yeah, I think 20 years.
Six guys started it. They've been insanely successful. I don't see any reason why five or six women or five or six team of diverse people, even if there's a guy in there, white guy in there, can't go form the next Benchmark and just kind of make a statement.
Right.
I think the money is there. I think the appetite's there. I think the deal flow's there. So I'm looking forward to those types of things starting.
Yeah. Do you worry just when you look at a lot of white male, when you look at the Silicon Valley investor base in general, this is something I've been thinking about a bit, just like to what extent they're plugged into like the country overall. And I think this is a way that's kind of bridging the two things we just talked about, which are A, a lot of folks in Silicon Valley just investing in Silicon Valley. B, a lot of firms, a lot of white men. Those two things together, I think, can create, you know, a scenario in which it's a perfectly legitimate question to pose, like, to what extent are investors in touch with reality?
So there's a couple of questions there, and I would say things are probably changing faster than you've seen. Uh-huh. I think if somebody's bread and butter is to invest in the enterprise or infrastructure or tech IT, a lot of that's going to happen in New York.
Yeah.
Bay Area is going to be the lion's share of that. I think consumer, especially on a national or like global level, people are on a plane from here every week.
Yeah.
So like, you know, one of my partners at Lightspeed, Nikki Quinn, I mean, she's on a plane every week. And now she's been doing some deals on the consumer side in LA and New York that aren't announced yet. But when they're announced, they're going to be like really interesting to watch.
Right.
And she's just on a plane. Now, what I have been thinking, like putting that aside, what I have been thinking about is San Francisco to me kind of feels like it's almost like a Hong Kong to China. It's like it feels like a completely different country. And I think there's some good from that where people here are just pushing the envelope. Like I was looking, I'm kind of a transit junkie. And so I was noticing in the time that it was announced that the old bus depot was going to be decimated and then like torn down.
Yeah.
And before like ground was broken on the new Transbay terminal, Benchmark did the Series A and Uber. Right. And you could argue that was a very global net positive event. I think there are some dangers of like getting out of touch, but I do think at least on the consumer side, I'm seeing a lot of people, whether it's Nikki or, you know, Hans from GGV, they're on a plane every week. They're not investing a lot of consumer here.
Right.
They're going all over the place. They're going to where those companies are being built.
Yeah.
I also think that when I moved here and maybe up until that point, and this is one of my big concerns for the region, it was possible to move here. And now I just kind of think about like, what would it take to move here if I was 33 again? And I was like, oh.
Economically, I mean.
Yeah. And so like, will those next great people move here? You know, and there's a variety of macro political reasons. There's cost reasons here. So I do worry about that. But, you know, to answer your question, in a way, I think it's important that the innovative, like the creators who come here from all over the world are divorced from reality a little bit because that gives them that creative license to go do that. But then we're also seeing some of the effects of like losing touch.
Sure.
With that. Now, what I would say in response to that is it's not a monolithic thing. There are plenty of people at all the major firms, especially on the consumer side, who mostly have portfolio companies outside the Bay Area.
Yep. Two last things. Another obviously thing in the news is still a lot of conversation about SoftBank. I think the interest has waned a little bit.
Are you a baseball fan?
I am a baseball fan.
I feel like it reminds me of that Reggie Jackson quote, like they're the straw that stirs the drink now in VC.
Straw. I don't know if they'd see that as flattering, but maybe not.
I think it's flattering.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a lot of interest in them last year. I'm still...
Oh,
we still worry about them all
the time. It's a topic of discussion amongst VCs weekly.
Sure. Do you still see them as, I mean, how would you rate them as the role they're playing here? Generally positive, generally negative?
I view it as it's a open market and there are no rules. And Masa-san and his team have figured out a product to create for these multinational corporations and sovereign wealth funds in countries where the economies are shifting.
Yep.
And giving them a way to diversify. How accretive that will be to those people is sort of an unknown. I also do see them investing in two kinds of companies. Like it's kind of an 80-20. 80% is around where does the consumer live? How do they live? Where do they go work? How do they work? And how do they get around? If you look at a lot of those investments, like I'm actually probably can't share which ones, but like SoftBank has actually followed into a number of the companies I've seeded. So I've kind of watched this develop over time. If you look at, they've done WAG, you know, they've done WeWork, they've done Uber, they've done DoorDash, right? This is like kind of getting into the consumer wallet.
Yeah, they like a lot of marketplace companies.
Yeah, and consumer focus, right? And so they're probably looking around the world as just saying like, you know, look at what's happening in Indonesia, Vietnam, Southeast Asia. Asia, you're going to have this massive like consumption upgrade. And these networks are like once in a lifetime networks to own a piece of. I think you see 20% around AI, and you could argue that, you know, even with our 2016 election, the ability to like use technologies like machine learning and AI are instruments of warfare, right? They're the arms that people deal in. So like SoftBank went to Carnegie Mellon and put almost $100 million in this company called Petum, right? They put, I mean, I don't know how much they paid for that English company arm.
Yeah.
Right. And so... They're 20% of their, what I observe is they're playing that game. But it's unclear whether the LPs expect a return. It's a place to park their money. It's unclear what kind of return you can generate from that fund. What is clear is that if you do have a jewel in your portfolio and that's going to drive your RR as a VC and you're about to go public or thinking about going public and that founder or founding team gets intercepted by SoftBank, and they can maybe raise triple the amount of money for a fraction of the cost and stay private and not go through that process. What does it do to your own IRR?
Right.
Yeah. I think that's the issue.
Last thing, I mean, so we've talked about, you know, firms getting more diverse. We've talked about late stage money. We've talked about whether or not we've seen, you know, firms become more meritocratic. Is there one kind of change you think that the VC industry will look like different in maybe 20 years we haven't talked about? Is there a change you might hope to see in 20 years in the industry?
Yeah, I think you'll see a lot. The early stage specialization will stay. And so people who have built up networks in these industries.
Very niche topics
will stay. There's the sort of orthogonal attack by crypto. We don't know what that's going to turn into. But I generally think like the best in breed firms, the firms that will like, you know, have been around for a few decades and will continue to be around for a few decades are going to be kind of like this word you hear all the time. They're kind of like platforms, but they kind of have a global nature. Like they're able to invest globally. They're probably managing in their vehicles $1 billion or more, and they're multi-strategy, meaning like the way I call it is they have multiple bites at the apple. What they have to do first is pick the right company to invest in, and the price and the ownership doesn't really matter. But once they start working with them and identifying that is the right one, you really go in hard, right? And then it becomes a way you have to fight to get in. Then you have to fight to build up your position, and then you have to fight against someone else coming and taking it. And so that's why I think a lot of those funds that'll be around in 20, 30 years are most durable will be multi-strategy.
Do you think that
even including fund of funds, like they'll have fund of fund like practices.
These are funds that invest in other funds.
Yeah. So you'll have the banner name of the fund.
Yeah.
You'll have a fund of funds practice to like funnel deal flow, find new GPs. You'll have your actual GPs running from seed to growth. And then you'll have like a way to invest in growth, global opportunities.
Mm-hmm. So you predict kind of fewer firms, maybe there are fewer, bigger monsters. I mean, or is it like in addition to kind of niche small guys who only invest in, you know, LaCroix bottles or
I think
markers?
It's hard to know, but I think you'll have the same number or potentially more of like larger mega funds.
Yeah.
Like you can imagine a firm like BlackRock having a shingle and investing across stage, just given how fundamental technology is.
Yeah.
You see Coatue doing this now, right? Coatue started as a public hedge fund. They built up a huge research arm. And then about 7 years ago, they hired a buddy of mine, Kyle Doherty, built out their U.S. office, started doing growth investing. And now they hired another buddy of mine, Matt Mazzio.
Right.
And now they're doing early. And so they're multi-strategy.
Right.
And really good at what they do. I mean, they invested at Snap at $2 billion.
Sure.
Didi.
Right. No, they've done pretty well, but they've shown how you can like, you know, do everything from investing in
the interesting academic question
public stocks to these.
Is it better to start off as VC early, then grow into growth and then have crossover capability?
Yep.
Or is it better to start over in public and work down? If you look at Coatue, it worked pretty well for them. We'll have to wait and see if the venture firms that are growing
right.
can sustain it to that level.
So basically you're saying that you're going to launch a public hedge fund eventually in 10 years.
That is way above my decision.
You'll gradually move from seed to hedge fund.
I try to keep things simple. Like my main thing, I end up getting attracted to the entrepreneur and like their story. It's kind of like mushy.
Right.
And then I just can't stop thinking about it. And then I'm just like, okay, they're off. You know, they raise like, you know, big round maybe a year or two later, and then they got bigger problems in dealing with me.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, Samil, it was great having you.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you.
Thanks. If you enjoyed the interview as much as I did, you can find more episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Or just visit recode.net/podcasts for more. Now that you're done with this, go check out the latest episode of Recode Media. You can find that show wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening to this episode of Recode Decode, and thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, our producer, Eric Johnson. Kara Swisher will be back here on Monday. Tune in then.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
This podcast was supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.